Alan Turing sat in his study at his home in Manchester, staring out the window at the city beyond. It was a hot but pretty day in June 1954. As he watched pedestrians of all kinds go about their lives, he couldn't help but consider how just a few years prior, he had worked diligently to ensure that they were at liberty to do so. He had saved a country that now sought to destroy him. Alan was gay, and that was something that post-war society wouldn't allow. The English clung to tradition and uniformity. They spurned what was different, not knowing that it was the diversity within their population that had saved them. In Alan's case, queerness was especially frightening to the government, as they worried that he would be more susceptible to blackmail. Looking down, he stuck a syringe into an apple, filling the fruit with a substance that he knew was deadly. He admired his creation. It was just like the one the Queen made in Snow White. He had spent the last few years researching the very building blocks of life, the structures that led to a leaf looking like a leaf, or to an apple looking like an apple. He believed in logic, in order, in understanding things. If only the British government felt the same. If his being gay was a problem, it was only so because of their actions. Rather than recognizing that it was their own prejudice that made him a societal outcast, they had tried to change him, filling him with chemicals with the same ease as Alan had just done to the apple. His body had morphed, though his mind had stayed relatively the same. But perhaps that was the problem. If he couldn't be both, if he couldn't be Alan in mind and body, then he wasn't Alan at all. It had taken him some time, but he realized now that he could only live a peaceful life if he conformed to expectations of heteronormativity. But to do that would be to sacrifice too much. What good was a peaceful life if you had to become a different person to achieve it? Moving to his bedroom, he sat on his bed. Then he took a bite from the apple. This is Espionage, a new Parcast original exploring the missions behind the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. I'm your host, Carter Roy. Throughout the show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. You can find all previous episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows on Spotify and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. New episodes come out on Fridays. We are also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This is our final episode on the cryptanalyst who won World War II, Alan Turing. Today, we'll discuss how Alan overcame the blackout of 1942 and became an important link between Britain and the United States. Then, we'll jump ahead to 1954 as Alan is put on trial for homosexual acts, leading to a tragic end to a heroic life. In the summer of 1942, the cryptanalysts of landlocked Bletchley Park, 50 miles north of London, were at their wits' end. After nearly a year of successfully decrypting German communications and subverting the U-boat threat, their machines had gone dark. The stream of intelligence had run dry. German U-boats fanned out in larger numbers than ever before, sinking as many Allied ships as they could spot. These half-boat, half-submarine vessels could disappear as rapidly as they appeared. In the vastness of the ocean, they were impossible to detect, and their torpedoes sank merchant vessels as well as military craft. England could not survive without outside imports. Bletchley Park's most famous member, Alan Turing, worked tirelessly to improve his decryption machines, known as bombs. The goal was to be able to decrypt the new four-rotor Enigma machines that the Germans had put into use starting in February 1942. This change had led to the intelligence blackout that the park was currently experiencing. Unfortunately, that fourth rotor had made the problem exponentially more difficult, and Alan simply didn't have the resources he needed to scale this particular mountain. He had a few dozen bombs. He needed 100. In addition to his professional frustrations, Alan was also facing his fair share of personal difficulties. In August 1941, he had broken off his engagement with fellow Bletchley analyst Joan Clark. Alan had known he was gay for most of his life, but he thought he could make things work with Joan. And yet, as the war continued, he found that he simply couldn't stomach such a deception, even if Joan was accepting of his secret. The only bright spot was that the Brits weren't alone in this fight any longer. The Americans had joined the effort in late 1941, though this came with some growing pains. Once they became aware of the importance of Bletchley's work in decrypting enemy communication, they immediately set up an equivalent office in Washington. Communication Supplementary Activity, or CSAW, was Bletchley Park times 100 in terms of resources. Even so, they didn't have Alan, and so they didn't have the bomb. But President Roosevelt had been requesting access since practically the day after Pearl Harbor. As the terror of the U-boats continued throughout 1942, the English finally relented and agreed to share the bomb and Alan with the Americans. Or at least, that's what they told their new allies. In reality, they informed Alan of a second, more vital mission. He was to help the Americans develop bombs, but he was to give them as little information as possible about Bletchley operations. While in America, he was to learn as much as he could about their own code-breaking technology and bring this information back to Britain. The hope was that British ingenuity combined with American industry would finally allow Allied cryptology to reach a scale that would overcome any German encryption device. It's not that Britain didn't trust its chief ally, but there was always the fear that making more and more people aware of certain information led to increased chance of the info falling into enemy hands. This level of secrecy and deception is common in spycraft, and Alan was experiencing it firsthand. He was already cleared to receive top secret intelligence. In fact, the British name for this information, Ultra, was taken from the code name for the very data that Bletchley Park produced. But now, with this American mission, he was being briefed on strategies that even his colleagues at Bletchley were unaware of. Alan's experiences mirror modern intelligence classification systems, such as in the United States, where the top secret designation has within it several further classifications that denote even greater levels of secrecy. These include the exceptionally controlled information and very restricted knowledge subcompartments. If such a system had been in place for Alan, his clearance level would have been the highest possible. His secrets had secrets. Alan was to depart for New York in November 1942. He was glad to learn that he would take an ocean liner capable of crossing the Atlantic in less than a week. He landed in New York City on November 12, 1942. From the get-go, it was not a smooth visit. Alan was held up in customs, where, according to his later report, he was, quote, kept on Ellis Island by the immigration authorities, who were very snooty about my carrying no orders and no evidence to connect me with the Foreign Office. Whereas in Britain, Alan's security clearance could get him just about anywhere, in America it meant that no one except a very select group of people had any idea who he even was. Ultimately, an American intelligence operative arrived and provided the proper documentation to allow Alan into the country. After a brief stay in New York, he arrived in Washington on November 17th, where he visited the CSAW offices and was generally unimpressed with what he saw. Again, the technical nature of his work is difficult to explain concisely, but in general, he seemed to feel that the American cryptanalysts were more concerned with the machines, the bombs, than with the mathematical theory that lay at the heart of them. It was also generally a difficult position for Alan to be in. He was surrounded by people asking him every sort of question when he had been instructed by the British government to, in fact, reveal as little as possible. He wasn't a double agent, of course. He was working in the Allies' ultimate best interest. However, he simply hadn't been convinced that the Americans working on the bomb was in anyone's best interest whatsoever. Once again, Alan was laying the foundations of modern spycraft without even knowing it. After the war, intelligence services became crystallized in organizational bodies such as the United States Central Intelligence Agency, and almost immediately, they were used to break the rules that their nations had publicly agreed to. Alan's mission seemed to go against the spirit of the Declaration by United Nations, the formal treaty signed by all the member nations of the Allied forces. It stated that each government pledges itself to employ its full resources, military or economic, against those members of the Tripartite Pact and its adherents with which such government is at war. How could Alan do this while simultaneously holding back information on Bletchley? However, this reserved attitude toward the Americans may have actually suited Alan regardless. In December 1942, he visited the National Cash Registers plant in Dayton, Ohio, where he came into conflict with American inventor Joe Desch. Desch wanted to make a variant of the bomb that required fewer vacuum tubes and thus less electricity. His version of the machine forced the gears, shafts, and circuits to work at extreme paces, often making movements in a fraction of a second. Alan had significant reservations here, believing that the thrum of the fast-moving parts would literally cause the machine to break apart. He was quoted as saying, "It would be unlikely that any machine could be kept in working order when it was asked to defy the laws of inertia." He felt the American design made a lot of unnecessary changes, and by the end of his time in Washington and Ohio, he seemed to have gleaned what he could from the Americans in the way of improving the bomb, but left them to their own devices after that. He wrote, quote, "I am persuaded that one cannot very well trust these people where a matter of judgment in cryptography is concerned." However, workers from both Seesaw and Dayton would later credit Alan with providing the groundwork for their bombs and cryptology methods in general. In a 1995 interview, American cryptology worker Bob Mumma said that Alan controlled the design more than anyone else did. And Alan did admit in his reports to England that certain improvements to the wiring of the diagonal board meant that the American bomb would run faster. While Alan's trip to America was thus far proving a mixed bag, back home at Bletchley, they were experiencing a major breakthrough. They were about to put an end to the blackout of February 1942. Next, a harrowing naval battle leads to another breakthrough for Bletchley. Now, back to the story. On October 30th, 1942, a naval battle halfway across the world from England would have surprising repercussions for the workers at Bletchley Park. In the waters of the Mediterranean, outside of Palestine, German U-boat U-559 foolishly surfaced in contested territory. It was immediately spotted by English reconnaissance planes and within minutes was descended upon by five British destroyers. Chief among these was the HMS Petard, which was commanded by perhaps the most ferocious naval commander on either side of the war. His name was Mark Thornton, and at 35 years old, he received as much respect as a man of 60. But whether or not this reputation was honorably earned is a matter of some debate. According to author Hugh Sebag Montefiore, Thornton was known to pelt his men with teacups, blast them with water hoses, and force them on insane drills that included swimming during thunderstorms. One of his men had even died during such an exercise. Perhaps because of this cold-blooded training, The petard quickly disabled U-559 in the water. Three men volunteered to dive into the ocean and swim to the U-559 to see what they could recover before it sank. The submarine's crew had already been taken prisoner. Nevertheless, it was an extraordinarily dangerous task, and thus speaks to the bravery of First Lieutenant Tony Fasson, Able Seaman Grazier, and Canteen Assistant Tommy Brown as they descended into the sinking vessel. Inside, water was slowly rising as the men waded into the captain's cabin. It was a small space, with the usual bunk, filing cabinets, and desk. But on the desk, there was something out of the ordinary, a large machine with four rotors and a keyboard. Next to it, there were several books with what looked like code words and phrases. The sailors' excitement grew. Was this the device the War Office had told them to be on the lookout for? The books were immediately passed to Tommy, who waited back outside, careful to keep the pages dry. On his way out, he could tell that water was filling the sub faster than expected. Depositing the books in a rowboat, he climbed back down the submarine's ladder to retrieve even more documentation. The other two men kept searching. They tried to pry the Enigma machine from its mount, but were unsuccessful. Tommy called to them from the ladder, begging them to join him, and they finally acquiesced, heading toward the exit. But then, the submarine lurched. They fell backward as the U-boat began to sink, and water threw them down the corridor. Tommy swam through the exit, bobbing to the surface as the German vessel and his fellow crewmen sank to the bottom of the ocean. He swore that their sacrifice would not be in vain. The recovered information was indeed worth the high price that was paid. At Bletchley, Joan Clark, Peter Hilton, and others made quick work with the discovery. It was a huge breakthrough. Not only did the codebooks provide them with fresh cribs and other data to break recent naval Enigma communication networks, but it revealed a surprising blunder on the part of the Germans. The installation of the fourth rotor hadn't been implemented to its full advantage. Thus far, it had been left in position A, essentially the default, and it had yet to be rotated. In modern terms, it was as if the Germans had added a second password on their laptops and just made the password 0000. German naval Enigma was broken once again. The U-boats could be hunted down. Allen was unfortunately unable to travel home to participate in this victory. The British government had another task for him. In January 1943, after some prodding, Allen's superiors were able to get him clearance at Bell Labs, one of the premier laboratories in the United States at the time. Many of their projects were geared toward the war effort, and so to work there was to accept a high level of secrecy. The British wanted Allen to learn what he could from the laboratory. According to biographer Andrew Hodges, within an hour of arriving at Bell Labs, Allen helped the researchers solve an issue with one of their scrambling systems. It was a problem that would have taken others weeks to solve. Allen found the researchers at Bell to be much more interesting than those in the government offices. Their work focused on radio waves and speech encipherment, essentially working to make phone calls between President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill more secure. It was this work, which required an understanding of electronics and their miniaturization, that would lead Allen to theorize about the machine that would one day evolve into the modern computer. His heart was likely always back in Britain, however. He stayed in contact with Bletchley, but wasn't there with them for the ups and downs that come with war. In February 1943, Dilly Knox died of lymphoma. He'd recruited Allen into the GC and CS, and the two shared a common background as Cambridge intellectuals with quote-unquote abnormal sexualities. Knox was more or less the Alan Turing of World War I and had contributed much to the code-breaking efforts of World War II, especially in regard to busting Italian decryptions. Alan may have regretted not being in country to attend the funeral. He was also missing out on the rewarding aspects of working at the park. On February 2, 1943, German forces on the Soviet front surrendered at Stalingrad after Hitler had forced them to fight to the proverbial last man. This brutal victory had been aided in part by information from Bletchley. There were likely celebrations that Alan was missing out on. With all of this in mind, and with the British government wanting Alan back home to share what he had learned, he set sail for England in March 1943. Now, regardless of how Alan felt about the trip to America, he had played a pivotal role in cementing British and United States relations. This cooperation had been a first for both sides, and Alan showed that safe, useful exchange of ideas was possible. He also helped the Allies figure out the logistics of sharing information back and forth. His holdup on Ellis Island, for example, revealed the need for transatlantic security credentials. Alan returned to England on March 31, 1943. When he reunited with his team at Bletchley, it felt like they hadn't seen each other in a lifetime. Since November, much had happened on both sides of the Atlantic. The Enigma blackout had ended, but surprisingly, U-boat losses were worse than ever. In March 1943, the Allies lost almost 700,000 tons of shipping, including food, medicine, clothing, and other essentials, as well as thousands of sailors. However, there was perhaps no more a dramatic reversal in the war than in May 1943, known to the Germans as Black May. With the combined advantages of ultra-intelligence, intelligence derived from cracking Enigma, a superior air force, and superior technology, the Allies sunk dozens of U-boats, over a quarter of the fleet. It was likely a big moment for the team in Hut 8 at Bletchley. The U-boats had always been their chief concern, and now their mission was accomplished. Alan and his fellow cryptologists had grown a small operation housed in a mansion into a sprawling complex that employed thousands. The heads of these various departments had at times been of more importance to the war effort than major admirals and generals. Alan himself bore the single most responsibility for this growth, his bombs having become the cornerstone of Allied cryptology. Not only that, but his trip to America had cemented American and British relations and allowed both countries to turn the tide of the war. And indeed, the tide had turned. From April 1943 onward, events would move quickly. In the summer of 1943, the Battle of Kursk was raging in the Soviet Union. Due to Bletchley intelligence, the Russians knew when and where the Germans would attack. The Germans were repelled, and the Russians began to push toward German territory. After that, Italy surrendered in September 1943, in no small part thanks to the efforts of cryptanalysts such as Dilly Knox. Also that month, American bombs reached their zenith, with over 100 in use in Washington. In the first part of 1944, a team at Bletchley Park, led by Thomas Harold Flowers, created the Colossus Machine, a computer based on Alan's theories. It was able to crack the Lorenz cipher, which was the encryption used to protect Hitler's own messages. There was literally no level of German communication that the park wasn't listening in on. And because of this, finally, on June 6, 1944, the largest military invasion in the history of mankind was underway. Thousands upon thousands of Allied ships crossed the English Channel, only safe to do so because of the work done by Alan and Bletchley. Hitler had been stopped from invading Britain. His invasion of Russia had been a failure. His grip on the Atlantic was gone. And now, his complete hold over Europe itself was coming to an end. Many of the original Hut 8 team were no longer together to appreciate this. At the end of 1943, Gordon Welchman, who had been with Allen from the beginning and helped him to perfect the bomb, was now overseeing multiple operations at Bletchley Park. He would later move to the United States and teach at MIT. Allen, for his part, continued the electronic speech encipherment work he had begun at Bell Labs, setting up his own lab at nearby Hanslope Park. Only Joan Clark remained in Hut 8, even though the Americans had completely taken over Enigma cracking by the end of 1943, she continued to provide assistance with any naval decryption labor that needed to be completed. The war was moving toward a victory for the Allies. Enigma had been cracked, Germany was on the defensive, and they could cast their minds toward the future, knowing now that they would indeed have one. President Roosevelt passed suddenly on April 12, 1945, surprising the public. Though he had been sick for the majority of his presidency, he hid it well. He, unfortunately, wasn't privy to the death of Hitler, who committed suicide later that month, though the exact date is up for some debate. Following this, on May 7, 1945, Germany officially surrendered. The war in Europe was over. Allen never seemed to dwell much on the war, however. In 1945, Allen was finally able to pursue his fascination with the idea of a thinking machine. He went to work at the National Physical Laboratory in London, which at the time was conducting research into a wide variety of technologies with potential practical applications. It wasn't a match made in heaven. Allen's proposed computer design was considered unworkable, in part due to the intense construction demands, such as the amount of digital storage required. Ironically, by modern standards, the computer only required a few bytes of storage. Not making any progress, Allen accepted a position at Manchester University in 1948. His work there, including a paper, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, would eventually be accepted as the foundational work of modern computer science. A happy ending was not in the cards, however. Allen was gay in an increasingly anti-gay Britain. Thousands of men across the country were being prosecuted for indecency, and not only was Allen gay, he was a former spy. He had more incentive than anyone to keep his sexuality a secret. These two aspects of his personhood would come into increasing conflict in the early 1950s. Then, in 1952, things came to a head. Allen's personal life exploded onto the public stage. Next, Allen faces jail time, or worse. Now, back to the story. In January 1952, mathematician Alan Turing had established a productive but basically quiet life for himself in the city of Manchester. It was a far cry from the previous half-decade of war, when every day had been a scramble to decode German messages and save Allied lives. This was all classified. No one knew what had gone on at Bletchley Park, which was now a center of operations for the post office. Once again, Bletchley's position as a foundational site of government intelligence meant it was subject to some growing pains. There were few laws in place to govern exactly how long the government could keep something classified, and from the point of view of the British Secret Intelligence Service, there was no reason to ever declassify anything. Traditional spycraft would dictate that compartmentalization of information is key. Though as these institutions have developed into modern times, the public has demanded some system of declassification be put in place. In Britain, the Public Records Act of 1958 would eventually dictate that all but the most sensitive of material be made available to the public within 50 years, though that number would gradually be reduced over the decades. In the United States, laws such as the Freedom of Information Act, as well as various executive orders, have led to a 25-year rule, though there are multiple exemptions and loopholes. Overall, the intelligence services of both major powers still enforce a high level of secrecy. This was never more true than in 1952, when Bletchley Park workers were still ordered to keep quiet under penalty of imprisonment or even death. Alan didn't mind this. The work that he was doing now was much more important to him. The idea of a thinking machine and electronic brain had been humming around his own brain since he was a boy. The genius that had followed him throughout life had also been accompanied by a sense that he was different. Different from the socially conscious gentleman class he was born into, and indeed, different from the women-obsessed, women-despising patriarchy he was expected to take part in. Alan was gay, but in his school years at Cambridge, this had not been much of an issue. At Bletchley, everyone was an outcast, and Hitler was coming for all of them. Sexuality was not a chief concern. But the post-war years saw a return to traditional values, an embracing of everything British. After all, it was the establishment who had won the war, the staunch traditional lions that made up the upper class. Alan was never one to follow a trend, however. He had had boyfriends in the past. In 1948, he had been lovers with a mathematics student at Cambridge, Neville Johnson. But after the move to Manchester, that relationship seemed to take a back seat, and Alan found himself looking for a new connection. It was perhaps unfortunate that he never found a significant match among the intellectual class of which he was a member. As always, the permissive hallways of a university provided a far safer environment for a gay relationship than in the general public sphere. Even more, the upper classes were far more likely to simply turn a blind eye to such a relationship in the interest of avoiding a scandal. Despite all of this, Alan never seemed to find a strong match in the academic circles that he ran in. Instead, he turned to the streets of Manchester. In 1952, Manchester already featured a bustling gay scene, if one knew how to look for it. The clandestine activities that Alan had taken part in throughout the war potentially suited him well here. Remaining inconspicuous is a major tenet of spycraft. As the Facts and Details Project notes, quote, "The best spies are often inconspicuous, scholarly types that are comfortable chatting up potential recruits at bars and parties and establishing friendships with them," end quote. And though Alan never received any formal training in this regard, he had spent the better part of a decade lying to his family and friends about what exactly he was doing for the war effort. Just as other spies would hand off secret documents wrapped in newspaper or talk to an asset while facing opposite directions on a park bench, Alan had to employ subtle methods if he was to find a potential romantic companion. Much of what the public now knows of Alan's romantic life comes from the work of biographer Andrew Hodges, who first recognized the tragic disconnect between Alan's heroic war service and what befell him just a few years later. In December 1951, 38-year-old Alan encountered 19-year-old Arnold Murray in front of a movie theater. He was an attractive young man without many prospects. His father was unemployed and abusive to his mother. He himself had trouble finding work and had been arrested for petty theft in July 1951. Hodges believes that Alan felt a certain sympathy for Murray and thus invited him back to his home. Their first sexual encounter did not take place until January 14th. After some awkward but genuine attempts at connecting, the two embraced, making love in Alan's bed without concern for what dangers might lie ahead. In the morning, Alan awkwardly offered to pay Murray, but he refused. Oddly enough, Alan thought he was missing £7 from his wallet, and he secretly wondered if Murray hadn't already helped himself to Alan's funds. This marked the beginning of a brief, tumultuous relationship in which Alan suspected Murray of wrongdoing, and Murray accused Alan of having trust issues. This reached a culmination when, on January 23rd, Alan's house was burgled. Nothing of serious importance was missing, but Alan suspected that Murray was somehow involved. According to Hodges, at this point, Alan wrote Murray and told him he never wanted to see him again, but then Murray arrived at his house regardless, accused Alan of not trusting him, and once again they slept together. Only then did Murray admit that he had mentioned his relationship with the well-off Alan to his friend Harry, who was very likely to have then decided to rob Alan's home. Alan, ever the champion of order, always determined to do things the right way, went to the police on February 3rd with this information, though he changed the details to avoid implicating Murray. This would prove to be a huge mistake. Within days, the police had formed a case, though not against the burglar, but Alan. They arrived at his home, interrogating him as to the nature of his relationship with Arnold Murray. Alan, always feeling that he shouldn't have to hide his sexuality, told them everything. They would never pursue the burglary case. On February 27, 1952, both Alan and Murray were forced to appear for their arraignment. Alan was able to get off on bail, while Murray was kept in jail for about a month before the trial. Hodges suggests that Alan received mixed support from his family. His brother John coordinated with a team of attorneys to ensure that Alan entered a guilty plea, though this was probably the soundest legal strategy, as Alan had already confessed in detail. It is hard to know whether his brother pushed for this out of compassion or out of a concern for the trial becoming a larger news story. In fact, the trial went largely unnoticed by those not in Alan's social circle. This may be hard to imagine, but the Alan Turing of 1952 was not the Alan Turing of 2019. Though now he is a war legend credited with laying the groundwork for the modern computer, at the time, he was an unknown. His work was, as always, classified, and computers were, of course, still a long way from changing human civilization. In 1952, the public thought no more highly of Alan Turing than they did of any professor at Cambridge or Manchester. Luckily, Alan's colleagues at Manchester University were supportive, though Hodges writes that it took some debate with departmental leadership before Alan was permitted to remain in his position. This was in no small part due to the championing of his supervisor, Max Newman, who had worked with Alan at Bletchley. Less encouraging was the revelation that Alan would no longer be allowed to take part in any government intelligence services. The news would later emerge that he had indeed been working in secret with former Bletchley colleague Hugh Alexander on new cryptology studies. Alan had always known that the government was against having gay employees in the intelligence services, and the old line was that a gay person was more susceptible to blackmail, though no one ever seemed to consider that simply destigmatizing queerness would eliminate that issue. Unfortunately, this attitude would only intensify in the coming years. Blackmailing someone for cheating on their wife was one thing. Blackmail revealing they were gay was considered an even more serious matter. Andrew Hodges notes that a 1950 United States Senate subcommittee concluded that, quote, "a homosexual or other sex pervert is a security risk. That conclusion is predicated upon a careful review of the opinions of those best qualified to consider matters of security in government," end quote. With all of that subtext simmering beneath the surface, the trial began on March 31, 1952. It was an especially painful ordeal for Alan. He was forced to sit and listen while his sexual acts were read off by the stodgy prosecutor. A tone of disgust was employed to make Alan seem especially deviant. Murray's defense worked to paint Alan as the older seductor to Murray's younger, innocent lamb. Hodges also notes that there was an air of condescension from the prosecution in regards to Alan's sleeping down, the fact that he had risked all of this for a relationship with a working-class man. Perhaps even more traumatizing for Murray, he was told by his family that his crime was dragging an upper-class man's name through the dirt. It was an era of completely closed-minded views toward sexuality. This was exacerbated by class concerns, the government's concerns over Allen being a security risk, and Allen's own refusal to even pretend to feel guilty. Luckily, the trial took a dramatic turn, just as the war had, as Allen's Bletchley colleagues began to testify as character witnesses. Though they were likely unable to speak to the scope of his accomplishments, or indeed any specifics whatsoever, Hugh Alexander referred to Allen as a national asset. Max Newman said that not only was Allen a welcome guest in his home, but he had been invited over multiple times, often playing with Newman's daughter. This was not some sex criminal to be thrown in jail. This combination of character witnesses and Allen's status seems to have prevented his going to jail. The verdict came down: probation, but on the condition that he submit to hormone therapy. Hormone therapy was a recent development in the quote-unquote treatment of gay people. Allen was to be regularly injected with female hormones to reduce or even eliminate his sexual drive. This was perhaps one of the more merciful treatments at the time: electroshock, forced vomiting, and even lobotomy were still in practice. Even so, it was still a horrific sentence. Allen would likely grow breasts. His body would not be his own. Fortunately, these injections would only be forced on him through April 1953. But throughout that year, Allen found that his publicly revealed homosexuality had other consequences. Hodge's research shows that after a trip to Norway in the summer of 1952, Allen had invited a potential lover named Chell to visit him in March 1953. When Chell arrived in England, he was turned away at immigration due to the government's concern that he was a spy trying to seduce Allen and learn his secrets. Since Allen was legally considered a sex offender, he was no longer permitted entry into the United States. His world had become smaller. His homosexuality may have felt more and more like a prison, but at work, he seemed as enthused as always. His research had begun to shift away from work on computers to more theoretical discussion of the basic structures that make up organic life. The mathematician was now becoming something of a biologist. In his personal life, he likely remained unfulfilled romantically, though it would be wrong to say he ever decided to give up entirely on pursuing gay relationships. It seems that he likely realized that continuing to do so might one day land him in jail. Or even more simply, he may have felt the intense depression that any would feel after a lifetime of persecution. In a letter to a friend dated from around this time, Allen wrote, quote, "I want a permanent relationship, and I might feel inclined to reject anything which of its nature could not be permanent." No one can know exactly what was going through Allen's head in these post-war years, but it seems clear that his sexuality weighed more heavily on him than ever. It was unlikely that he would be able to pull off a successful long-term gay relationship in the current social climate. The burden of state-sponsored bigotry, the lack of respect for all he had accomplished in the war, the lack of affinity he felt with the upper class he belonged to, it all led to a man who was very troubled. Eventually, Allen reached a breaking point. He was found dead in his home in Manchester on June 8, 1954. There was an apple lying next to him with a bite taken out of it. Investigators would later find traces of cyanide. A great ambiguity would arise from this detail. Had the poison been placed intentionally, or had Allen accidentally gotten it on his hands after an experiment? The chemical was being used in an experiment literally one room over from the bedroom. But Hodges theorizes that this was on purpose, a ruse to keep Allen's mother from thinking he had killed himself. The apple simply carried too much significance to not be deliberate. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was Allen's favorite movie, and he had written before that he found the Queen's poison apple especially mesmerizing. Allen was dead, and though his friends and family mourned, the larger world scarcely noticed. They had no idea that he had saved Britain. However, in the 1970s, the work finally became declassified. The world was allowed to know about Bletchley Park. By the 1990s, a trust was set up to preserve the park, and in modern times, it's a sprawling museum with the grounds completely restored. Exhibits share the full history of code-breaking activities, with men like Alan Turing, Hugh Alexander, and Gordon Welchman featured prominently. Besides this direct legacy of code-breaking, Alan's impact on computer science is especially significant. The universal Turing machine designs of the 1950s eventually grew into the original personal computers of the 1970s, and today, mankind uses computers with a frequency and literacy that Alan predicted decades earlier. He wrote in his 1950 paper, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, that by the end of the century, referring to a machine as thinking would become commonplace. And as scientists continue the search for true artificial intelligence, the metric against which all computers are measured has been given a very appropriate name, the Turing test. With such a legacy, it's easy to forget that Alan Turing was one of the most, if not the most, successful intelligence operative of all time. According to the BBC, he may have shortened the war by as many as 4 years. That's millions of lives saved. And it was done not with a gun, nor a carefully placed explosive, nor a daring high-speed car chase. No, it was accomplished at a small desk in rural England with paper and pencil. Not every spy is an action hero. Some are just good at math. Thank you for listening to Espionage. For more information on Alan Turing, amongst the many sources we used, we found The Imitation Game by Andrew Hodges extremely helpful to our research. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find all previous episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Espionage is written by Greg Castro. I'm Carter Roy.